You stand for the reading of the Word of God this morning.
Well, you should be getting familiar with this passage unless you're visiting with us today. We've been here for a month. We're in Numbers again, chapter 13, beginning the 25th verse. I'm going to read down to 14, verse 10. At the end of 40 days, they returned from spying out the land, and they came to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the Israelites in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told him, "We came to the land which you sent us. It flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Yet the people who live in the land are strong, and the towns are fortified and very large. And besides, we saw the descendants of the Anak there. The Amalekites live in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites live in the hill country. And the Canaanites live by the sea and along the Jordan." But Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it." Then the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against this people, for they are stronger than we." So they brought to the Israelites an unfavorable report of the land that they had spied out, saying, "The land that we have gone through as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people we saw in it are of great size. There we saw the Nephilim." The Anakites come from the Nephilim. "And to ourselves we seemed as grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them." Then all the congregation raised a loud cry, and the people wept that night. The Israelites complained against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become booty. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt?" So they said to one another, "Let's choose a captain and go back to Egypt." Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the Israelites. And Joshua son of Nun and Caleb son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes and said to all the congregation of the Israelites, "The land that we went through as spies is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord is pleased with us, He will bring us into this land and give it to us, the land that flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord. Do not fear the people of the land, for they are no more than bread for us. Their protection is removed from them. And the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." But the whole congregation threatened to stone them. The word of God for the people of God. Maybe see. Well, as I said a minute ago, we began this the first of the summer. It's already July. Here we are, July. June is gone. 4 weeks came and gone quickly, and we've been looking at this story. And I will give you a quick review each week because some of you are new here today for the first time. Some of you have been out of town. Maybe you heard one, not the other, and some of us, as I said last week, just can't remember what you heard last week. So here's a little review. We started with this idea that we're preaching about the promised land, but not literally. We're using the promised land. This story is a metaphor for the idea that just as God had a plan, a promise, and a purpose for the people of Israel in this land, so God has a plan, a promise, and a purpose for all of us. We began with that word from God through Jeremiah that said, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. I consecrated you. And surely I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper you and give you a future with hope." So all of this is grounded in a few basic ideas about God. One of them is it's God's desire to bless us. God is a father who loves his children, and just as we long to bless our own children, so God longs to bless us. But God's purpose in that plan to bless us is that He blesses us to be a blessing. It is not an end in itself. And that God, thirdly, that God makes and keeps His promises. We can trust God. God is a covenant-making, covenant-keeping God. And finally, that all of God's plans and purposes and promises require some response on our behalf. We have to walk down the road He lays before us. But what we're largely focusing on is that Israel failed to enter the promised land. They let all these different obstacles keep them from going in and fulfilling this plan and receiving this promise. The first of those obstacles I described as internal obstacles. That, in other words, that the first things that stood in their way were things that existed only in their own mind. It was the way they saw ourselves. We looked at that line that said, "And to ourselves we seemed like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them." What we said is that they had a small view of themselves because they saw themselves only through their own eyes, their own ability, not through God's eyes and what God saw in them that they maybe didn't see in themselves. And we do that about our own selves sometimes, trying to live into God's plan, and we feel like it's too much for us. We also spend way too much time comparing ourselves to others, and so we seem like grasshoppers, and so we seem to them. And that not only do we compare ourselves to others, but we begin to project our own insecurities onto other people and think that we think that they think this about us, and we have no idea what they think. The real problem was their God was just simply too small for the task that God had put before them. Then we looked at some external obstacles. That is, some very real things. It wasn't just in their mind. There were some very real things that stood in the way of entering in. First of all, we said there was no unoccupied territory because the first choice was, let's find a little corner in the land where we can just slip in there with no opposition and we can just carve out a little niche for God and the people of God in the corner of life. And I thought about how we have a tendency to want to do that. You know, God put something on our heart, a plan, a purpose, and for our life. And the first thought is usually, you know, can I just find a little corner in the corner of my life somewhere that I can start to live into this plan God has for me and not have to change anything else? But there was no unoccupied territory, and there is no room for that. When God calls us to something, inevitably there are some things that will have to go. Secondly, it said that there were many different enemies. They were all shapes and sizes. Some of them were inherently bad. There are some things in our lives when we start to follow God that we know have to go. They're obvious. But there are other things that there's nothing inherently wrong with. But it doesn't mean that they can stay there. I mean, sometimes it's just not the right time or the right place for us. And something in our life, it's not there's anything wrong with it. God just says it's not for you right now. Not at this place in your life. And so we have to examine every part of our life. Thirdly, it said they had walled cities, strongholds. In other words, they couldn't get to their enemies because there was something that insulated the enemies from them. Paul talked about that in a spiritual sense. Paul said that he described strongholds as persuasive arguments against the knowledge of God. In other words, Paul said when you live in the world, you live in a world of ideas. And not of all of those ideas are godly ideas. And that when we swim in that world of ideas all the time, it's really easy to start to buy into those things. And if they're God's ways or thoughts are not our thoughts, His ways are not our ways, that we sometimes will struggle with thinking that it's okay with this is a part of my life and this is okay because the world says it's okay, but God doesn't. So we've got to figure out what those are and to remove those. And lastly, he said there's a giant in the land. There's a spiritual enemy. There is one formidable spiritual enemy. Jesus called him the strong man. But he is able to overcome him, for greater is he who is in us than he who is in the world. Last week, we looked at the obstacle called the lure of the past. And we talked about how faced with an uncertain future, it is often tempted for us when we need to be able to walk by faith in God, we want to walk by sight. We want to be able to see where we're going. And when we can't, sometimes it's tempting to go back where we've been because at least we know what that's like. And we will retreat into the familiarity of our past rather than risk the uncertainty of the possibility God has for us, even if it could be greater than anything we can imagine. We sometimes can't escape our past. We did say that there is at least one time in our life when we may have to go back. And that is, sometimes we don't like where we are. We run ahead of God. We make our own plan for our life. And one day we wake up like that prodigal son in the far country, and we realize that I'm in a place that God didn't intend me to be, and then we have to go back. We have to go back in order to start over. So sometimes we have to retreat. We call that repentance, where we start all over. Which brings us to this morning. And the next obstacle to living into this promise, this plan, purpose that God has. Now, we spent most of this series talking about God's plan for my life. It's how we think. As Americans, one of the difficulties with applying the Old Testament to our lives is that we think individually, me and God. The Old Testament, God relates to Israel collectively, us and God. And we have a hard time getting around that. We think God has a personal plan for me. But Israel had to think God had a plan for us, all of us, not just for me. So it's important for us that when we think about God's plan for our lives, it's important to remember my life is intertwined with a whole lot of other lives. And that God's plan, when it's for me, is also for us. It affects other people. In this story, God's plan for Israel was, as a whole, they would inherit the land. 12 spies come back. Joshua and Caleb were the only two who come back and say, "Don't be afraid, God will give us the land." And the other 10 saw the same good land and said, "We can't go up against this people. They're stronger than us." And suddenly, the biggest obstacle to entering the promised land now is not who's in the land. It's the division, the rift that has now been created among them. They are a divided people. They are in disagreement with one another. And whenever we're in that place, it's really hard to live in God's plan for our life when we're in a place of disagreement and division. The problem in God's plan for Israel is that Caleb and Joshua can't just take their tribes and go on without them. You do what you want to do, but we're going on without you. It's all or nothing. They all have to go. And the only hope of their success is unity, that all of them can go. You see, no matter how much you and I seek God's plan in our life individually, that plan inevitably involves other people. So if there's division and disagreement in the principal partners in our lives, it's really difficult to watch it walk in God's plan. Remember how Jesus put it, a house divided against itself can't stand? It's true of a church. It's true of a marriage. It's true of a community. It's true of a nation. When we are divided, that is our biggest obstacle. Remember that quote we began with, that old Pogo cartoon from a bunch of years ago that said, "We've met the enemy and they are us." They are us when we're divided. I mean, for example, if I'm married, God's plan for my life is also inevitably a plan for my spouse's life. You can't separate those two things. Being together has been a part of that plan. Therefore, if we're not in agreement upon the pursuit of that plan for our lives and for our marriage, it's going to be very difficult to walk in. Now, I look back, my wife and I, in our own life together, a lot of you know that, you know, she didn't marry, I tell people, she didn't marry a Christian much, that's a pastor. And so my wife didn't sign on for this life. And she didn't sign on for pastoral ministry, but when I reached that point in our life that I felt like God was calling me to that, I went to her and I said, "Now, I know this is what I feel like, this is what God is calling me to. But if you know, you didn't ask for this, you didn't marry a pastor, and if that's not a life you feel like you can live with and live in, then I'll find some other way to live out my calling." And I truly was trying to be, you know, genuine and humble and loving and all that stuff. And so she went with me, and all these years, and here we are, we just finished 30 years of ministry, and she's lived in all of that, And yet years later, we were having a conversation with somebody, and we were talking about that story. And she said this. She said, "You know, you said, you know, if you don't want to go, you know, then I'll find some other way. I won't go if you don't want to go. We need to be together on this kind of thing." She said, that wasn't really a choice. He said, "What are you saying? I can tell God no, but you can't?" Yeah, that's not a choice. But we have to have unity in our lives. It's also the case for the church. We're partners with other people in living into God's plan and purpose as the church. You know, I always say when people join our church, we believe that people, you were led here at this season of your life for a reason. God wanted you here because you were needed here. You needed the church needed you. Really, we're not just members of a church. We talk about joining the church as members. I have a friend who has a church. They don't have members, they have partners. I think it's a better word, isn't it? They become a partner in the ministry of that church. They become a partner in the ministry of God in the world. So the story of Israel's failed attempt to enter the promised land, it reveals a lot about some of the unhealthy ways we respond to our disagreements in the community of faith, whether it's our family, our church. And the way those disagreements get really infectious to the people around us and destructive when it comes to walking in God's plan. See, the first problem is when the 12 spies come back, they don't focus on what they agree upon. I mean, they agreed from the start. God had rescued them from Egypt and was taking them to a new land. They agreed upon that. They even agreed that it was a good land, a land full of milk and honey. But when they get back, they focus all their effort and energy on what they disagree upon, whether we can take the land or not, whether we can trust God or not. Because when we're divided, how often it is we get focused not on what we have in common, not on what we agree with. We focus on our differences. Instead of building on what we agree with, we focus on things that are negative, not positive. I mean, think about how many marriages struggle because we forget sometimes how much we love each other because all we can see is the things that we're so frustrated with each other about. We take our eyes off the things that we have unity around. When we have a disagreement and we focus this time and energy on the disagreement instead of the goal, we get lost in what the goal was. Instead of talking to people, other thing that we do, instead of talking to people we disagree with, we have a tendency to go to other people and start stirring up support for our position. When the spies come back, you would think that these 12 spies would go to Moses and they would sit down together collectively, and Moses was their mediator. And they would talk through this whole thing that was in front of them, and they would come to some consensus together. But instead, they don't go to Moses. They go straight to the people. They go straight to the people. The 10 spies do. They begin to stir up strife and disagreement among the people. They want to get people on their side. Oftentimes, we don't want a solution. We want to be right. I mean, how often is that we don't want to figure out a way that we can all win? We just want to win. I mean, we do that. Instead of talking and praying with people that we have disagreements with, trying to come to some sense of unity, we just try to build armies for our side. And that kind of negativity is infectious. It bleeds through people rampantly. And all it does is guarantee failure for everybody. Those 10 spies begin to project their fears, their insecurities, their lack of faith onto everybody else. And people begin to buy into it, and it just spread across the people. Thirdly, we have a tendency when we're in disagreement to vilify the people who disagree with us. Yeah, even if they're our family or friends. With Israel, the issue is no longer about entering the land, about God's plan, or even about who their enemy is. They have a new enemy. The new enemy is Moses and Joshua and Caleb. It says the whole congregation, they stir them up and they threaten to stone them. The very people who led them out, led their armies, delivered them to this place, and they want to stone them. You know, forget the sin, just get rid of the sinner, because they're a lot easier to get rid of, right? Forget seeking consensus, let's just win. None of us are walking in God's plan in isolation. We are a part of a network of relationships. Husband and wife, parent and child, pastor and parishioner. We're part of the church. We're the body of believers through which God is working out His plan for salvation for the whole world. And when we're focused more on what we disagree upon than our plan, our purpose, our promise that God has made us, we get paralyzed and ineffective. The book of Acts tells the story of the most effective, successful, explosive time of growth in the history of the church. The church was newly born. But one of the ways that church was described in its earlier days, one word really characterized it. It was the word unity. Luke put it this way in the book of Acts. They were all together, and they had all things in common. they understood what they had in common. They showed it both when they were in agreement. They even showed it when they were in disagreement. There's a great story about the first big disagreement in the church, about the distribution of food to the widows who were in the community. But instead of becoming an irreparable rift in the community, they all sat down together and they worked out a way. Who was going to do this and who was going to do that and how we could make it work. You know, Jesus' final prayer for his disciples is they would be one, as he and the Father were one. See, I assume that we are here in part. All of us are here in part because we're convinced in some way that the church is part of God's plan for our lives. And the church is part of God's plan for the world. And the question is, when we're in the church with all these different people and all these different ideas, how do we avoid our division and solve our divisions? And I guess what we already talked about really speaks to that, right? First of all, don't we have to understand and agree upon our common purpose? And whether personal relationships or in the church, one problem is the church has so many ideas about what is our plan, what is our purpose. Most successful, life-transforming organizations in the world are, some of them are 12-step groups. You know what they have in common? One, they have one purpose. They only exist for one thing or try to do anything else. Sobriety. Everybody's after the same thing. And if the church could have that kind of unity and understand we're all about the same thing, then we don't make each other our enemies, you know? And we also need to acknowledge that we share a common faith. That's not to say that people aren't in different places in their walk, but if the church ceases to be a community of believers that are centered around our common faith in Jesus Christ, He is the center. Remember, Colossians says, in Him all things hold together. So if He's not kept at the center, things will fall apart inevitably in the church, in the world. And if we discount other people's faith because we disagree with them about what it means to live it out and don't give ourselves any common ground to work together, we'll struggle. Just as we see divisions in our nation, I mean, you wonder, do we any longer see ourselves as one nation under God, sharing some kind of a common faith and a common purpose for Israel? In the end, it would not be their enemies that prevented them from entering their land. It would be themselves. It would be their own division. Now, one last thing. All that being said about the importance of unity and the importance of how we overcome our differences, there is a last lesson that we need to learn if we're going to pursue God's plan and purpose, promise for our lives. And that is, there is no escaping the fact that often God's plan will create some disagreement. And it will create some division. Consensus is not always immediately possible. In other words, it doesn't always come easy. Not everybody buys in easily and quickly. Not everybody senses the same call and has the same place. For instance, one of the most disturbing things Jesus ever said was in Matthew 10 when he said, "Do not think I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have come not to bring peace but a sword. And I have come to set a man against his father and a daughter against her mother and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And one's foes will be one's members of one's household. Whoever loves father more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever does not take up the cross and follow me is not worthy of me. For those who find their life will lose it. And those who lose their life for my sake will find it." That's a troubling passage, but I think all Jesus says is that sometimes following where He goes, inevitably there will be some difficult places and some disagreement and division. In the end, Moses, Joshua, and Caleb will have to choose to stand against the majority opinion. Sometimes we will be faced with choosing between conformity and obedience, having a comfortable lack of conflict or a difficult walk of faith. And I will say, however, that if that's the case, we better be real clear, if we're sure about that hill we're about to die on, that we're clear that that really is God's plan and God's purpose for us. And there's one other difference in Joshua and Caleb and the rest that we really already touched on, and that is Joshua and Caleb only want to save the people from themselves. It's not about them. They just plead with them, don't rebel against God. They know that this is not going to end well. They know that there will be consequences to this rebellion, which is very different than the other ten's response to them, stone them. Just kill them. Get them out of the way. If you know the rest of the story, God honors the faithfulness of Joshua and Caleb. They are the only two who will get to enter the promised land, but it will be 40 years before they do. But make no mistake, it was a long 40 years of wandering. I think the amazing thing about Joshua and Caleb to me is that somehow they kept their faith and they avoided bitterness that they spent 40 years wandering around that wilderness when they didn't have to because everybody else wouldn't go with them. You know, faithfulness to God can be a long and difficult journey. You might remember how Paul put it near the end of his life, I have fought the good fight, and I have finished the race, and I have kept the faith. So when there's disagreements among those of us who are called by God, we work for consensus, but we don't compromise on faith. We work for our commitment to the plan and purpose God has for us, and we hold on to our confidence. God is faithful. God will keep His promise. God will complete His plan. God will fulfill His purpose. Maybe nothing speaks to that more than gathering at this table. We're about to come to the communion table. It speaks of that, right? This is the place where we all have something in common. Christ died for us while we were yet sinners. We have that in common. And we share that common call that we, with humble, grateful hearts, live out our faith that honors Christ and shares the good news of that gospel message with a world who does not know that there is a God who loves them. So this is our unity. As you come to this table, remember what we have in common, not what divides us. Amen.